Welcome to Life After Business, the podcast that helps you understand how to increase the value of your business, what your company is worth, and what your exit options are. Host Ryan Tansom and his guests give you all the information you need to get clarity and control over your business and take pride in a valuable company that gives you freedom and choices to exit on your terms.
Hey everybody, and welcome back to the Life After Business podcast. We are hitting episode 173, and today's guest name is John Thielen, also known as JT. I am so excited for this episode because if you're listening in and you own a company and you're trying to figure out how to handle conversations with your second in command, align their objectives with your eventual growth and exit plan, or you're trying to figure out how to hire that person, what qualities you should be looking for and what good looks like, this absolutely is a must listen to because JT's on the show today to share his entire story about how he used to work in corporate America and his skill sets were growing and scaling companies, how his insane discipline and mental models allowed him to help grow a company that was doing $4 million in revenue up to $10 million in revenue, and then help sell it for 11 times EBITDA. And JT shares the ins and outs of what it's like as the second in command. Essentially, he was running the entire company when they sold. He was the president, and he was the true integrator, as the EOS model puts it. He shares how him and his owner met, how his owner, Steve, had conversations. They had 11 meetings, how they got on the same page, the three different things that they did to get on the same page, how when JT started, they aligned his comp plan to profits and revenue, and how that perfect combination allowed JT to take the company from $4 million in sales up to $10 million in sales, and then selling it for 11 times EBITDA, all within 5.5 years. He took his mental models and his discipline and scaled the KPIs across the organization, put true systems that allowed them to just blow the roof off of the sales and the scalability of their business. And he explains what it's like inside the head of that person that's doing all that work, growing and selling in business for someone else. He also shares what the process was like hiring the investment banker, looking at all the deals, who he sold to, and really what you should be thinking about as an owner as it relates to your second in command, because I think that this is one of the biggest pieces of the puzzle that can completely sabotage someone's growth and exit plan. Because if you have someone like JT, if you have someone that is literally your person that you can't lose and your linchpin, how are you aligning their incentives in order to get you to your goal? How do you handle the conversations of, hey, I think I might sell in the next 1, 3, 5 years? How are you going to compensate them? And making sure that you have the empathy to understand that it's emotional to be that person that is doing a lot of real hard work for someone else to get a huge check, and how to make that a non-issue because everybody's on the same page and then you're going to battle together through open, honest conversations and transparency. Seriously, this is one of my favorite episodes because it's a conversation that needs to happen between the integrator and the visionary, and as it relates to the growth and sale of the business and who's getting what and how to get on the same page. And you're going to learn a lot from JT's experience. If you want to know more about how to put your own plan in place, how to figure out what your growth and exit look like, check out one of our boot camps. It's based on our 5 principles. So the first one, you'll figure out what is important to you and why. Is your legacy, community, whatever's important to you, you stack that on top of the second principle of your financial targets. What's your company worth today, net after debt and taxes? What's your target annual income and your target net worth at closing? And how do you then stack that on top of your exit options between private equity, ESOPs, third-party strategic sales, family transitions? And then when you understand where you're trying to go and why, you start focusing on value creation, which is what JT did amazing. Instead of focusing on annual income, optimize for enhancing the value and the multiple of your business that gives you freedom and choices to hit your exit options and your drivers and your financial targets. Then you wrap that all together with your team of advisors to optimize that plan. Check it out. It's 2 days. It's $5,000. And it's also half off for anybody that you want to bring, whether it's your partner or if it's your CFO or family. We had at the last boot camp, we had multiple groups that everybody got on the same page in the boot camp, and it was an absolute blast. So if you have questions, reach out to me at rtansom@arcona.io. Reach out to me on LinkedIn, however you want to get in touch with me. I'm happy to walk you through the curriculum and the agenda. And with that being said, please tune in to this amazing episode with JT.
sponsored by Arcona's Growth and Exit Boot Camps. 2 days jam-packed with material on the 5 growth and exit principles and the world of mergers and acquisitions. You'll walk away knowing exactly what steps to take to get your target valuation and your best exit option. 2 days at Arcona's Boot Camp will give you the clarity to control the rest of your journey as an entrepreneur.
Happy Friday, JT. How are you doing?
Very good. Thanks.
I'm excited to have you on the show. For the context of the listeners, I was sitting down at one of the local entrepreneur networking events, actually, where we saw an economist speak that I had interviewed probably about a year ago or so. You and I started talking, and then it was the energy, your story, then you had twins, and you like to work out, and you like to have beers, and I was like, huh, I think we check
all
a lot of them. All that's true. Yeah. Yes. No lies there. So you told me your story, and I was like super excited to get you on the show because you come at this the growth and the sale of a company from a completely different perspective, from being the key manager and the executive on the deal, working with the owner, and here we are. And so maybe for the listeners that aren't familiar with you and your background, where did you start off? How did you get into business?
Okay. So again, my name is John Thielen. Everybody calls me JT, but my background is primarily sales and business development and managing teams to achieve a shared vision sales growth number. So my background involves 4 startup companies and also 1 SaaS company from the Midwest over to San Diego. So I've been fortunate enough to grow quite a few companies. And so I've typically held CRO type positions in those companies. And so from as small as opening up an office in Minneapolis called CitySearch.com to I ran SanDiego.com and created a national network there of City.coms across the country. Cool. And I worked with AOL on a big project. That was probably my biggest job, where they put $350 million into launch a platform for hyperlocal news across the country. And we hired 1,000 people without anybody knowing it, because we didn't want the newspapers and publications and other media sources to know about it and say how negative it will be. We wanted to be disruptive. So I was one of the earliest adopters for that. And I ended up being promoted and being a publisher, director of sales, managing 4 states and 60 cities, and having about 80, 85 indirect direct reports. But primarily, I'm a revenue-driving executive.
So in as we kind of go into that, because it's going to probably tie into some of the strategies that worked at in the last business that you were in, but what are the revenue drivers, and like what was the makeup of how you would, what falls under the chief revenue officer? And the reason I'm giving that question some context behind it, JT, is that in our 4th principle, we have what it's called increased value, and sales and marketing are 2 of the top 8 value drivers, and creating repeatable systems behind them. And so I'm just kind of curious in your experience in the different ventures that you worked in, what would make that up for you?
Yeah. So just to get inside my head, one is that you dream it, then you demand it, then you execute on it. So let's say you dream of it. So what do you want to grow something to? And then, because you and I are very KPI focused, Darren Hardy compound effect type guys, well, okay, that's a dream, but let's back into this number and from the most granular and say, hey, what do we need to do on a weekly, monthly, quarterly basis to hit this, we call it BHAG. So what I would have been able to do is digest a number, backtrack into it, and say, what do I need to do every single day and to grow that? So then it comes down to what must I hire? And, is it inside? Is it outside? And, it is trial and error, but one is just you try to put things in place to grow the product. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've been able to do, even from this last job, that I was able to scale and sell a company.
I love how you said that, and you digest the number and you back into it, because I was interviewing this guy, Jack Stack, and he very well articulated in the kind of the great beginning of business. I don't know if you're familiar with his material at all. But he says, okay, you start with a strategic plan, what markets, what geographic location, product service mix, et cetera. Then you have your sales forecast, and then the financial forecast should reflect your sales forecast and making sure you're making money. Because because growth consumes capital. So how do you determine like what was the process of digesting that number? Was it like a revenue number? Was it a profit number? What was kind of the key metrics that you're measuring?
Yeah, it typically varies, because the businesses I've been in is that MRR number and monthly recurring revenue. Mm-hmm. So it could vary from, okay, I get a sale, but cash in the door is another conversation. So sales and revenue in the door are completely like cousins, right? One cousin you like more than the other, right? So I would, in the last company I was at, we broke down that number down to gross sales as a KPI. And then we broke down to our leadership KPI was how much recurring revenue is coming out of that. I end up having to put initiatives in place to have a fast and effective onboarding campaign to have those come close to matching. But with those other companies, which were, let's call them advertising driven companies, well, you would pay me $500 a month. Well, if I sign you for a year, that's $6,000. So that was pretty easy. Mm-hmm. And every sale, the business goes up, $500 in revenue, and I have six reps doing that, then it multiplies. It got a little bit more complicated at my last fast company, where we closed business and revenue trailed.
So let's get into it, because I want to hear, maybe we can get into the most recent projects and how you did this. So how did you're jumping from the publishing and the sales publishing and marketing world. What was the journey to finding the recent gig?
Okay, that's an interesting one. So when we were growing Patch through AOL, that big initiative, Tim Armstrong was the chairman and CEO of AOL, and he was getting a lot of flack out of New York nationwide about, what is AOL doing? They don't have deep pockets. Is this run rate profitable? Are they spending too much? And so what happened is the board of AOL started going, well, you got to get this, hit your projections. Well, that was not as visible to us, even myself, who was managing four states and 60 cities. I knew what we were doing on sales, but what rolled up to New York, we didn't see on a national basis. Mm-hmm. He started mentioning that if we, we might have to have some error, recalculations. And then one day, now that I look back on it, he was unable to sell the board on continuing. Out of 1,100 people, 936 were laid off one day.
Oh my God.
And I was one, including myself. We called into a conference call line and said, hey, well, what's the next plan initiative? And then it was that. And then AOL ended up selling off the property to, I think it was Hale Global, another private equity group, and sold it off. So I was at a cabin trip with my wife and kids. And I'm like, at that point, my wife has twins in the oven at 8 months.
Oh, they were not even born yet. Oh my God.
Not even born yet. And I went, okay, well, that's a curveball. And so
that's a curveball. It's a nice way to put it, right?
Yeah. And I actually emailed Tim Armstrong, the chairman of AOL, that night. And then he was gracious with me to put something together, a package financially and stuff, and severance and healthcare and benefits. And it was fantastic, right?
Oh,
for me.
That's really cool.
But that didn't solve, what am I going to do next?
Mm-hmm.
So what happened is I started looking around. And there's this lady that came across my network named Debbie Wright, and she's an EOS implementer. And she said, my husband has been looking for a guy like you. And I said, well, what's a guy like me like? Maybe we should have coffee with him. She goes, we bought a background screening software company for $2 million, small company. And we put in EOS, but we don't have the key integral parts of running it done yet. Steve Gustafson is a visionary who is not accountable. He's has big ideas, but everybody, says, yes, we'll do that, but then goes a different direction because he'll wear out and fizzle off. He was kind of a seagull management, come in there and poop on everything and fly away.
I have not heard that one before. Okay. That I'm going to be stealing that one.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. You're going to remember that one. So what happened was I said, I'm from, a different business category. I would love to have coffee with him. So we end up having probably 11 meetings.
Holy
at D.B. Bryan's and Edina, just talking about philosophies and what I'm like and what what gets me out of bed and how did I become, you know, successful at a young age. You know, I was director of sales at 27 and opened up an office for City Search at 25, right? So I thought, well, I said, really what triggered it for Steve was this conversation. I said, I've always been a wild bull, right? And where my career really got focused is when I used discipline. You and I talked about the compound effect. Well, I end up meeting a guy in San Diego that was a decorated Navy SEAL. And this is the guy that was SEAL Team 5 under CIA Delta, only doing capture kill missions.
Oh my gosh.
And his background is he got a degree in English at SMU and finished up at Oxford, right? You know, he's a really smart guy. And so he did tours in at Iraq, normally it's Fallujah, and then it was Africa. And then what happens is after his time there, he's not he's probably 3 years younger than I am. He got out and he says, well, I'm going to get my MBA at a University of San Diego. And I met him at the gym. Okay. And our relationship just hit it off. And I was enamored by him, that he was a Navy SEAL, because that's the mental discipline on that. It's like,
is insane.
I was that guy. Right. And then how he could just hit his goals and accomplish it. So he gave me this mental discipline. And I started reading SEAL books a lot that, you know, you can accomplish anything if you put it in front of you. Like I graduated SEALs, Buds 235 with Michael Murphy from The Lone Survivor, who that happened. Actually, he passed away that show. Well, that he graduated with Michael Murphy. He was out of 200 people. It was Brent and him were the 13 that got through. I said, well, how did you do that? He goes, they're not, you know, my brain was higher level. I thought, well, they're not going to kill me. You know, I guess I could die. But he goes, reality is that I look at it, the end game. And then I say, if I get past today, then check, I'm mm-hmm. stronger than they are because I'm overcoming this. So he taught me mental discipline and being accountable and say what you're going to do and do what you're going to say. So that's a little bit of, you know, what I've morphed into. So when I met Steve Gustafson, the CEO and owner, 100% shareholder of the company, he goes, I'm looking for a guy like you and let's just work something out. I need you to be the integrator of the EOS model. I need to have people held accountable. I need vision. What EOS also lacks, even though it's a great framework of operating your business, it lacks vision and growth sales initiatives and swim lanes to get
and strategic
one,
planning, right?
Five
yeah. And yeah. like actual strategic planning, like as in like, how are you going to actually get there? It's funny. Cause I was right as we jumped on, I was saying that I just did a presentation to a couple dozen, EOS, business owners, or there were business owners that run an EOS. And then I said, a strategic plan is not going from 10 million to 15 million. Like that's a goal. Right. I mean, like there, but like, how are you going to actually do it? It's a different story, right? Like there's different
yeah.
choices.
And that, even though I was like, well, I can't tell you how we're going to do it today, but it does take trial and error and we horse correct. And so I came into this organization, his wife and Debbie Wright and Steve was like, I want to make this a $10 million company. And I said, well, at the moment, the people who work here don't know what a $10 million company feels like. Of accountability and process. So let's do it. So long story short, I ended up, you know, success is never an elevator, so it's steps. So we made some moves and we end up just continually growing the company and between $800,000 to $1 million in revenues per year. And we went from, I got there, the company was doing $4 million in revenues. And again, he bought it for $2 million. At this point, he grew it a little bit. I got there right around $4 million, and I end up growing at that $800,000 to $1 million or more. So you know, 18.
And you're saying is that money? Is that monthly? You're saying so you're going from $800,000
monthly recurring rev. Yep, that's MRR, monthly recurring revenue. And then I ended up once we I got it down up to you know then 9, and then you know then 10 million, and we 20. You know, we got our EBITDA up to $2 million. We'll talk a little bit about that, why that's the most important. And so,
yay, yay!
Yeah,
someone's
someone's
talking about the important numbers. I love it.
Yeah. So here's this. You'll like this. This is what Steve ingrained in me, and I'm like this too, personally and professionally. It's not what I make, it's what I save. So a lot of people are not like that, right? I became a millionaire at my age because I save, not because what I make. That's how I think, right?
You have $1 million worth of debt and stuff everywhere.
No, I'm liquid. So what Steve said is like, Johnny, we're not here to play store. We're here to make money. Well, that's the difference. Some companies have the mentality of let's grow top line, but not the bottom line. So he also mentioned that there's two truisms in business. Expenses always creep up and revenues creep down. So you got to be diligent on pushing revenues up and pushing expenses down. And so it hit home to me because I was like that in my own household. I went, bingo. Let's not play store. Let's make money. And by the way, let's financially reward you, JT, on that. I said, this is what my program was. I'll be honest. It's like I was paid quarterly and annually at times and some metrics, but the key drivers were profit. So I put a plan together. We agree to it. Some of it's stretched. Some of it's realistic. And on my quarterly bonuses, let's use that as a clean example for everybody listening here, 75% of my comp was on my ability to hit profit numbers. 25% of my comp was based on my ability to hit revenue numbers. So again, if you put incentive plans to change behavior, well, put the right behavior in.
Right.
The behavior we did was profit, not so much revenue.
Okay, so I want to keep going. And before we keep going, because this is some meaty good stuff, because you know, for the listeners who own companies, I'll kind of go back and I want to kind of maybe hit on a couple of the things you spoke on throughout that part of the journey. Is one is that, you know, I'm making my partner and I read Rocket Fuel because again, it's the whole intergenerator visionary. You know, Gino Wickman has been on the show. I've interviewed a bunch of EOS implementers, and so very tried and true to our heart. But like, again, I think you said that misses a couple pieces of this. Is one is that how do you find the you, right? So, I mean, if I had a dollar, JT, for every single time I said or someone said, I need to find an integrator, right? Because there's an interesting dollar amount. To kind of give some context as I'm going to kind of touch on some of your points is that when you're able as the owner's able to afford you, and then how do you take your comp and how do you tie all this to the ultimate outcome, right? Which is you talking about start with the end in mind. So this Eric, it was Eric, your owner, you were saying? So he sounded Steve Gustafson is what you said? So Steve has very, you know, first of all, he's already decoupled himself from the focusing on annual income optimization to value creation, right? So comments on quit playing store, let's focus on EBITDA. I mean, I was part of Vistage and where everybody's like, I did 20 million in revenue. I'm like, who cares? Did you make any money? What's your EBITDA? You know, so you and I are speaking the same language here about focusing on what's right. So a couple of comments on how to find someone like you. And then what was your package? So that bonus structure, I want to get more into that too. But then how did you get, how did that actual onboarding go? Was there equity? Was it just cash bonuses? Was it, you know, tied to an ultimate end? And then, so that's kind of the first question. Second question was, is the bonus structure, did that include normalized EBITDA? So I'm curious if it was just profit or if there was ways to increase the value of the company. So,
yeah, good point. So yeah, that's true. So, through all those questions, I was fortunate to have an owner named Steve who, you know, he had a finance mind.
Okay.
Right. So he was in the business. He bought this company as, let's call it, an investor mindset rather than this is my lifelong dream of running this company. So that can separate some owners from other owners
a lot. That's a huge difference, right?
Right. So, how he found a guy like me was he was looking for somebody that he could relate to one and go to battle with. Right. And a very transparent person. So you're very transparent. I'm an open book. That's served me well because my why, and I was big on my why was, A, I like to create value. I like to say I did something. So maybe this comes from being a small town farm boy kid that has a twin brother that wants to say, hey, I'm successful. Well, I like to create something. So that bodes well for an owner that says, hey, good. I like to create something too. Let's create something together.
That's
right?
Awesome.
So that made sense. And then I'm big on a shared vision, right? So, okay, now if an owner said, hey, this is what I want to do, and the core values align, well, then you know what? I'm your guy. I like to partner with somebody. My last three jobs I've had, I really connect well with my direct report and shareholders. So it's kind of, I want to take one step back. It's kind of like this. My best advice of anybody in college or in the real world is this: your direct report or boss, find out their one thing is. And so you know where you stand. If you do that one thing, then you know that you guys have a synergy. So I did that throughout my career, is knowing my boss's one thing. And so then I would do it. But a lot of people have this mentality like, well, these are the five things I'm working on and everything's important. No, what's your boss's most important first? First yeah. important, and everything gets trailed down and you kick ass, right? Yeah. Right. And so I was big on that. So again, if you have a shared vision, then and we say, let's go do this, I'm the guy you want in a street fight. Because I'm like, let's do this. I'm all in. Because that's my personality too.
I want to go to battle with you right now, right?
So and then three was, you know, I want to, this is matching this core values. And then I like creating relationships. So Steve Gustafson, I sold the company on January 4th. And I talk to him every week. He calls me every week just to talk. And so, you know, I'm a different guy, but I like to connect with the people I spend my time and work with. Because I'll do it for you. I'll give you my all. But maybe it was unique.
I think it's the fun part about it too, and like I think everybody wants that. And then maybe go and explain a little bit about the package, because I've heard so many times where like the owner gets infatuated with someone with your skill sets potentially, and then they immediately just give equity, doesn't tie it to some ultimate outcome, and then there's a big falling out or something like that. So like, did you like, was there an equity package, or was it, you know, growth and equity or some phantom stuff?
This, you know, the next time around it would be different, but in this situation, this was a thief, was a Minnesota S Corp 100% shareholder, him and his wife. And so in this situation, when I came in, he was very generous on salary, and he was I would say even more generous on yearly comp and quarterly comp based on, hey, if we do what we say we're going to do, you're going to make a lot of money. And so at that point, we came in synergy. Mm-hmm, and then once I was able to grow the company in year two, year three, we had more of these discussions on, okay, what's the exit end game? And that's where I end up working out a deal at the end to make some money,
okay,
real money at the end. But no, but I made a lot of money along the way.
Which makes sense. I think it's a good point though, because like, you know, to be generous up front, because, you know, I think, you know, there's a delicate balance of an owner giving equity too fast, too soon for without the reward. But then again, if you grow the value of that asset and you grow the cash flow, you can pay through income and cash like you were with the bonus structures that you're tied to eventually get to where there's a bigger event, right? Because it doesn't happen unless it happens together. So in your bonus,
exactly.
No, go ahead.
So Steve was big on that, hey, if you can make me more money, I'll make you make more money. And so that really rang true to me. So I thought, oh, interesting. If I can double his income, well, I'm gonna ride up that wave as well, right? So I came in, you know, making, Steve was big on, hey, I'm gonna be my side of the street's gonna be clean. I'm gonna give you what you're asking, and but we're going to create a plan and vision where you're gonna make a lot more, and I'll prove that to you. Mm-hmm. And fortunately, over the course of 5.5 years, you know, I was making twice as much as I ever made. Right,
yep,
so
yep,
it's all yep. worked itself out.
Yep. So in that, in your bonus structure, then JT is the. Was it just profit and revenue based? Was there actually any normalized? Because I've worked with different comp plans And then also, you know, with the ultimate, you know, end goal. And if Steve is focusing on value creation, which he was in the beginning, a lot of this stuff recalibrates. Because I see, you know, someone that's not focused on value creation is that focused on how much money they can make, which then would not allow them to hire someone like you to give you the benefit. So the mindset shift, like you said, right off the bat, allowed for this whole circumstance to kind of
create. Well, Steve was smart at the start. He said, I need an integrator. I have an entrepreneur operating system, traction, you know, system. And he goes, what I need is the most important piece of that, which is an integrator. Mm-hmm. Right. And so he budgeted for that. And then I ran with it, created a financial model saying, hey, 35% of the pie will be COGS, 15% will be sales and marketing, 15% will be G&A, and 5% IT. But guess what? 30% goes to the shareholders. So so JT, when you build your plan out, take into effect that you know
that's a fact.
25 to 30% going back to the shareholders. So yep. I think any owner listening to this, or trying to grow their business, if you're looking for a partner to help you build it, it has to make sense, and you have to really connect with that individual and have a lot of conversations and about how you both can win. Be mm-hmm. be open and honest about it. Mm-hmm. And then then it becomes clear.
I couldn't agree with you more. It's so awesome that you've got such a humble view of that too, and a realistic view. So on one that like the note on the comp plan, I am just curious. Was there a normalized EBITDA? Because and were you able to control all those models? Because you know, there's a couple of things in comp plans that I see go completely south. One is the comp plan is put together, and then the person actually can't control everything because there's micromanagement and you're kind of getting dinged left and right. Or the other one is the other piece of that would be is that it's not on like what we call the normalized EBITDA, right? Where it's, you know, you need to be investing in the business to grow the value of the business. So how did you balance investing in the business and your comp plan? I mean, was there any discussions?
So, good question. So when let's say we put this budget together within the budgets and the cash flow would be the top line revenues that would happen monthly. You know, we were a monthly recurring revenue, so we would have our targets. So Q1 would be, we're going to go from 600,000 to 700,000 to 800,000, you know, top line revenue. So the bottom line where I was paid, let's say on the quarterly side, was on the net income, yep. operating income. So not right down. There's some things below the line that Steve didn't want to penalize me for.
Yep.
So, for example, like my budget said, I'm going to bring in $500,000 of net operating income to the business. Well, then that's how we're going to pay you on mm-hmm. of hitting your goal. Mm-hmm. And so then it was just a clean 75% whatever the number was can be paid out on profit, and 25% of that will be paid up on revenue, okay. And that would be your quarterly bonus. And then we just kind of ran with that. There'll be some things
simple and good though.
And it's clean and simple for me to understand. You always want your comp packages to be understandable to your employees. Gosh,
yeah.
I've had so many that I've had, like, I'll kick butt and I have no clue what I'm going to be paid on. Right.
It's so true, isn't right? it?
You need, you know, again, if I'm, you know, it's kind of like if you're going to go into the alley with a street fight, you want to know what you're fighting.
Yeah.
Right?
Bazooka or knives or what?
that guy's too big. You know, but it's just imperative that everybody understands how they're going to get paid, because that's how you're going to get the most out of your individuals and salespeople too. They will give them their all, and then you can help reward and celebrate them along the way because it's clean and simple.
So let's go into the growth of this, because maybe give some of the metrics all the way up to the sale of the revenue and the profit or whatever the profit, the net operating income or the EBITDA that you're measuring. And so kind of give us the framework or outline of the growth project, the milestones that you hit. And then what were the strategies that you were putting in place to accomplish it?
Okay. Well, that's a long story, but I'm going to try to simplify it. When I first got there, I had one salesperson who's making a lot of money, but he was the director of sales. He was the VP of sales, but it was only him. And everybody was focused on that one individual. And I wanted to create a sales team. I wanted to create a customer experience team. I wanted to have account management team, because if I was able to drive revenues, new sales, net new sales, A second thing I need to do is onboard them the right way. You know, use the term of dating. You need to date somebody. You can't one night stand somebody and expect them to stay forever. So if you onboard them and bring them in and take care of them and like, how's everything happening? You're gonna have a long-term client. So what can I do great on CX, right? Mm-hmm. So the onboarding and then customer experience and then account management team. So that's some of the internal things I did well there. I did hire some salespeople from the industry. And Debbie Wright, the EOS implementer, which is his wife, Steve's wife, would say, John, you're a master recruiter. You know, we didn't know that about you. Like, people like your energies. And so I was able to get people to leave their bigger jobs to my job. Mm-hmm. Right. And it's because I had this, you know, speak of, hey, this let's create something. Let's have the best job, last job. That's mm-hmm. how I call it. Best job, last job. Because wouldn't that be amazing if like you created something and you can brag, but these bigger companies you work with, you don't necessarily have that. So I recruited people from the industry that were bigger than me to join my little company. And what happened was we ended up creating a national sales team from San Diego to South Carolina to Chicago. And so we are getting nice sales. And so, but over the course of that growth we've had, I found out that my director of sales, which he was a great guy, wasn't the best for our next level. And outside national reps for us cost a lot of money. We closed business, but the revenues trailed so much. We wanted to go in a faster close cycle. So I wanted to go into inside sales model. So I thought we can do more growth, more volume, faster by having inside sales reps.
So can I interrupt you for a second? Just quick questions. Yeah. I want to dive a little bit more into how you built out that sales function and the different roles and responsibilities. Maybe because I think we skipped over what words that you were actually selling and how was the product and service actually bought and what was the client actually engaging with you guys for?
Okay. So we were selling employment background screening and then residential background screening to nationwide. But most of our business was just in Minnesota. And my initiatives there was we look like a Minnesota company. We look like a small regional Minnesota $2-3 million company. Well, first and foremost, that's going to change. We're going to look like the big guys, you know, make it till you fake it, right? Make it till you make it. So we went through a brand re-strategy to make us look like we're a national company. And then we started. Because anything we sold in Minnesota, we can sell in San Diego. Mm-hmm. So what we started doing is selling to those other geographical areas. And then we were able to start getting revenues in from other streams across the country. And then, well, by the time I sold the company, you know, I think it was 35-40% of our revenues came outside of the state.
Oh, wow. Cool.
My dream of being a national company was coming true because I dreamed it, demanded it, and executed on it, right? So it's just a dream if you don't try. Now, there's some failures in there. You know, I started growing the outside sales team, and we got to a ceiling where it was not working as well, and it cost a lot of money to bring those types of people in. And then we brought in a marketing director to create more of a marketing channel, and we started focusing on small, medium businesses. And those were highly profitable to us. And we figured that out along the way that maybe we should just continue selling these small, medium businesses. Yeah, they're not as sexy as a $100,000 account, but you sell a $5,000 account, they start right away, they bill right away, and you just do that more often.
And you make more money potentially too, right?
And you make more money. And our margins were, you know, 30-35% versus 20%.
Well, and so some of the stuff that like, just to point out what you guys did is like, I mean, so when we look at, there's a system we use to look at like the ways to increase the value of a company. So you go through and say, okay, in the sales and marketing drivers, it's like, are you geographically, you know, can you geographically expand? Are you doing outside sales, inside sales? How are you doing your marketing? So, I mean, you did a lot of that stuff and you grew into
help other people. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. And I think maybe, do you have any, you know, comments about how, like with the salespeople, did you have like a revenue per, like how fast did the salespeople pay for themselves or maybe some metrics that you used to compare like in growth, you know, to grow that sales function and then pivot? Because the reason for the question, JT, is that you know, most of the time when we take people through this assessment, strategic planning is very weak. Sales and marketing are not repeatable processes. And then the finances are usually, you know, not adequate. So in the sales and marketing, if someone's got to build out a repeatable process and like, you know, they're going down the digital marketing route or they're going down the sales route. I mean, there's all these different ways to generate revenue. So what were some of the metrics that you did to build that out and then to pivot? And what were you looking at?
Okay. So again, from the outside viewers, you know, my businesses might be a little bit different than theirs, but what I did is first and foremost, having visibility KPIs on what you're trying to grow. So, having a salesperson pay for himself, one of my leadership KPIs on the sales side was, you know, what is their reoccurring revenue, not sales, but the revenue they're bringing in. And I can, you know, I can analyze that against what I'm paying that individual. And so that just tells mm-hmm. a story, a KPI that tells a story. You know, sales growth, you know, that's just, I'm just comparing numbers from year over year, mm-hmm. make things simple in my own head. And so, again, it's like lifting weights and building muscle. You have to zero in on what you're trying to grow and see it year over year and see, you know, how is things changing. So we put those things in. You know, I looked at what I'm spending on marketing and what the net is coming out of that. And so you're looking at a lot of different, you know, pieces of information. And it's kind of like the Jack Welch book. Like, you know, not everybody's a finance guy. I wasn't a finance guy, but what did the finances have to tell a story? What's the story telling you? And that's where Steve and I would look at and go, what's this telling us? Mm-hmm. What's the story telling us? What's the finances telling us? Okay, we found out that national salespeople that were paying $85,000-$90,000 a year base salaries and then commissions on top of that, well, their monthly recurring run rate takes a heck of a long time to pay off, to pay that salesperson off.
Right.
But if I had an inside person making $45,000 a year and they're closing higher margin business, well, then now I have more room to invest in the other areas of the company to grow,
mm-hmm.
i.e. marketing dollars, mm-hmm. right? So there's no easy answer other than those trial and error and seeing trends and what's working and what's not, and then course correcting.
But I agree with you on that point. But also what it's proven that you're showing that you had the numbers and accurate information to be able to make those decisions. Because again, you can't make those decisions if you don't have that information.
Yep. And so that's a little bit of EOS to me as well. Like, what's the most important numbers? What's the most important numbers for the leadership team? Then what's the most important numbers that we can track on the sales and marketing team? What's the most important numbers on an operation? And we build KPIs and we actually personally built KPIs week over week. Is our kind of business.
Oh, really?
Wow. We did week over week, yeah. And green was par, like that's what we want. And yellow was bogey. And red is we can do a lot better. So if you see a sea of red, then you got to look at, okay, well, I've seen 6-8 weeks of red. Well, you know, it's telling us a story, right? And why, and let's deep dive into that. And
by the way, I just have to tell the audience that I saw your 5-year spreadsheet of your workouts that are built like this too. So it's a real thing. I can only imagine what you did for a business if you do that for yourself.
Yeah, I'm the king of compound effect. I live and breathe it, don't I?
So
again, that's my discipline of how I use energy to go one direction.
How do you focus on that stuff? So as you guys are running, you got week over week, you're getting the data, like, you know, what is the method inside of that they're using to focus and how to actually figure out and prioritize the different things that are sitting in front of you?
Yeah, you know, I would say I was fortunate. You know, I hope I'm not come across I, because I'm only as smart as my team that I brought in, which you become smarter because you get the better successes. But my IT director was able to create this, ownership report that I would say, hey, I want you to be granular and create a line item that tells me this, right? And he would be able to build it. So I would know what a guy named David is doing on daily revenues coming in the door based under his name, right? Mm-hmm. And weekly and monthly. So that helped me be able to go, oh, I can create this situation. Mm-hmm. Okay, mm-hmm. let's do this.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had all these value points that I could build a story off of.
As you are building this machine that's growing significantly, and you said you started having a conversation with Steve about what's the exit, and you kind of built your package. You guys both started talking about the exit. Explain the conversations you started having and what the ultimate goal is that you guys started solving for, and then kind of how that started moving in that direction.
Okay. Well, this will be unique because at this point, I've been successful at this company now. I'm the president of this company. Steve is planning, he's at this point moving away. He's moved down south. And so Steve became really only, became a friend, even though he's my owner of the company, because he was more of the board to me. He would come in and chat, hey, how are things going? And I would just roll things up high level to him. Mm-hmm. And give him weekly reports and monthly reports of how things are going, things that I'm working on. So I bet you a lot of owners wish they had a guy to go, hey,
you're making a lot of people jealous right now. You're making a lot of owners going, how in the hell?
Hire me. I'm looking for work. So then the business is just making money and it's doing really well. And we found a sweet spot in this SMB marketing channel, selling, software, SaaS, subscription, screening. And so what Steve came to me one day and said, John, I'm thinking about taking some chips off the table and, I need you to help sell the company. And if we don't get the price we want, then I just go back down south and hang out and take distribution, which is fine too. But, wrap your head around that, JT, he said, and, let's talk. So I was on a trip with my wife out in New York, and he ironically was there at the same time with his wife, and we went out to dinner and just talked. And so I became fully engaged in helping him sell the company.
So, and if I could just peel that back just a little bit, JT, is that conversation I think scares the living shit out of most owners, because
it scared me too. It did scare me too.
Well, I appreciate the honesty, man, because most owners avoid it like the plague, try and like do an end around their number two like you, because you could potentially hold them over a barrel. You're the guy. So I'm just, how did you guys deal with that? And I'm curious of the conversations that your guys' families had.
Yeah. At the time, I wanted to make this much bigger than a $10 million company. I had a great job. I'm a president of a company and I have some great people within it, and I didn't want to lose that. And there's a pretty great chance I sell the company, I'm not there anymore either, right? Mm-hmm, and mm-hmm. There's synergies that take place. So there's this fear of it. And I knew that if I did this right, my shareholder would, have exit money of retirement, right? And I still would need something to do. I had a lot of things in my mind personally and professionally. I'm going, well, what's next for me then? But again, I'm just going to go back to, maybe it's me. I had a shared vision with this my shareholder, my owner, and I'm going to take great pride in doing what I'm supposed to do and do it really well. And then Steve's wife would talk to me about it. And I was like, the fear of breaking up like a relationship to me was big. Right. Like, gosh, we have a good thing happening and do what we're doing. But I had to get over that because it's going that direction anyway. And I had to get on board. And so I spent some time talking with my shareholder about that exit package and making sure that everything's going to work out. And so we did that. Or then I started feeling comfortable mentally. Right. So now that owner got his guy on board. And I'm sure Steve, he felt, my owner, that he needs me to sell the company. Mm-hmm. Who else is going to do it? Because he's now detached and away from the company. And here's the big part, Ryan, is that he didn't want to be, if in the event he didn't want the company to get sold, he didn't want to be brought back in to run it or a buyout. He wanted to, hands off, I'm done, moving on with my life. So that being said, that made a bigger role for me where I had to do all the private equity calls and all the presentations.
Did you guys hire an investment banker, or like what was the process after that conversation? And before we get really into the process, go ahead.
So we hired, just to make it clean for the listeners, we hired a banker because you need a banker. And then we...
An investment banker, not created, broker, based on your size?
Yep. Investment banker, right? So we went West Coast on this because that Steve found one prior to the conversation. And so what they end up doing for us is creating a selling deck. We'll aggregate the data, create a data room, put all the right information in there, and then create the selling deck of the best parts of our company that we really do well. And then once we got all that data, which was a long, long process.
Did you get due diligence data? Is that what you're saying? Due diligence?
Yeah. You know, if you're planning on selling a company, I would say start thinking a year in advance just to get your mind around getting all this information in place. Right.
At least. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're going to need soldiers who are going to help you do all this work too.
Mm-hmm.
So besides bringing me in, you're going to have to bring in maybe your accountant, your CFO, your compliance officer, because there's a lot of information that's going to be requested from you that you're not going to know. And I didn't know, mm-hmm. right? Because I was above the weeds. Mm-hmm. I was an eagle running the company with joysticks. But down to the granular level, that was the hardest part of getting all that information presented the right way to create this fantastic data deck that told this story on numbers. So that being said, we created this deck. I actually hired a life coach during this process because I was, A, you're nervous, but B, there's a lot online, and C, I wanted to be firing at all cylinders to make sure I'm not nervous, I'm saying the right things, and I'm talking to an audience that is different than me. They're private equity.
Sophisticated buyers.
Yeah, and they have, in my mind, they have a little hubris where they think they know more than you of your company, but they had never been in your company, right? So, right? Then the deck went out. This deck went out to this network within their network. And then we had, let's call it a dozen people that wanted more information. And so then I would be on 75 minutes calls each to speak about the company and what, essentially what I'm doing with you today, mm-hmm. What I did and where we can improve and things that I think I can, we can do in the future to make it a $20 and $30 million company. And they would drill me with questions. And I did this and end up getting 9 offers that was good enough for the, let's call them full price offers. The approach we took, everybody, is we did an auction.
Mm-hmm.
So we didn't set a price out there what we're going to sell the company for. I was just going to present this company, and it's probably good that I was just kind of a sales guy, sales minded guy, because I was selling my way through the company.
Totally. Right? It's the biggest sale of your life. Yeah. Yeah.
Right. That's how I looked at it. I said, I want somebody to write a monster check. and Steve is probably in the background going, yeah. Right. And Steve only spoke a little bit of the numbers at the very tail end of all these presentations. I can't share exact numbers, but I was able to sell the company for 11 times our earnings. So
I love it.
And then it became that company to engage with. And here's a term, some business owners out there I learned. Yeah, letters of intent are nice, but they're really indications of interest. So you should really call them IOIs in my mind, mm-hmm. because they're just spaghetti against the wall. When a letter of intent becomes real is when you start the due diligence process and you start really getting in the discussions. So, at times I felt that the company was going to sell and not going to sell, even though I had all these offers out there. And Steve just said to me, Johnny, if it doesn't work out, we got a great situation. We'll just keep going along. And so the due diligence time started, and all of a sudden we had a bunch of analysts and nerds come in and pair everything up and verify everything and see if they call that the quality of earnings, diligence,
yep.
Right? So I want everybody to understand that a letter of intent doesn't only means what they're interested in, but it can go south quick based on the quality of earnings. And that it came back to support the letter of intent purchase price. And then on December 31st at 9 o'clock. I saved this voicemail. I had to run. I worked my tail off. I thought this deal's not going to close because, you know, it's in the lawyer's hands at that point. And then I had to run to the hospital. My daughter had hand, foot, and mouth, my 12-year-old.
Oh, my God.
And I'm sitting there going, I can't wait to drink. And because I'm so stressed out.
Yeah.
And I get the phone call that we sold the company.
Wow.
And it's going to close effectively on the 4th. And so it was New Year's Eve night. And I went home, made a powerful drink, and I didn't even want to go out. We had all these plans to go out with friends. I said, I just want to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm just drained. And so the new company took over, and that was it. I stayed on for 5 months after to help them integrate. And based on since May, I've been a free agent looking for what's next for John Thielen.
That's so cool, man. And I just got to say, like, because I was essentially you in my deal, right? I mean, it was a family business. It was me and my dad. And that, I mean, our stories, like we say, are like, you know, even down to the twins are fairly similar. And, true. How did you, so for me, I had whiplash for years. Cause like, we're selling, we're not selling. And like my comp plan was not perfectly like clear. I mean, I figured out how I structured all mine, but like, was it very clear? Was there like some sort of phantom stock or some sort of like flat fee or something that you and Steve discussed for the success and the integration? I mean, like, how did you mentally deal
with
that?
Yeah, you know, I wish it was better. You know, there's at times I look back and, you know, I wish it was, you know, done a certain way. But when you're a small business doing, drinking out of a fire hose, and this will be my first scale and exit, you didn't know what you didn't know.
Yep.
Right. And so we just agreed to a financial number,
yep,
at the end of the day, and a severance and an employment contract,
yep,
for myself. So I was taken care of.
Yep.
But there's other ways to do it. Like one of my friends in town is a COO and partner of Meristem Wealth Management. They manage $3.8 billion under management in Minnetonka. And, you know, he mentioned to me all the ways certain executives could be rewarded and exited. Well, you know, next time around, maybe. But when you're a small company and you grew it to, you know, more of a regional player, and the shareholder is 100% owner, and you have to find ways to work around that and find ways that we're both going to feel good at the end of the day. And
it's so funny.
So both our sides of the street are clean. You know?
It's a good way to put it, man. And what I personally dealt with, JT, is like we said to, so when my dad and I had the conversation, I said, you're either going to overpay me and you're going to resent me. You're going to underpay me and I'm going to resent you, or we could figure out what we think is fair. It was a really hard conversation, yeah. But
hey, great, great point you just made. And that's where my mind mentally was. I didn't want to feel like I took advantage of him. Right. So you might be shocked. Oh, wow. Your president doesn't want to take advantage of an exit. Like, well, I care more about the person and the guy I went to battle with for the last half a decade than I am looking at getting one over on him.
Mm-hmm.
I could have, yeah, of course I could have held it, you know, held the feet to the fire.
I didn't have a non-compete.
Yeah. I didn't have a non-compete, and I was the president and I was selling the company, and I was in a great spot. But you know what? At the end of the day, we have one life and one lease on life. And, I want to have relationships long-term. And so I can honestly say that in my heart, I love Steve. I love him.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I talk to him once every 7 to 10 days, just about life.
Nope.
You know, I was down there after the sale, hanging out with him on his new boat, hanging out with him. That's a relationship that'll be lifelong. And I feel good at the end of the day, and he feels great at the end of the day. And onward and upward, right?
Yeah, and you've got like, and I don't know what your thoughts are for, you know, for owners that are going through this and they're working with someone like you and they're going to battle. And like, I just, you know, you'll learn so much and you've got plenty of time to do this multiple times again. You know what I mean? Like, and that's the kind of the way.
Yeah, right.
I mean, you know, it's going to be interesting to see how it all unfolds, but like, you know, you'll learn so much. It's like, I don't know if you thought this way, JT, when you got done with it. It's like a different game. It's a different level of a playing field when you got the private equity and different people up there compared to what normal owners are sitting there trudging away. I mean, it's they're moving numbers and creating value and doing things that you just, most people don't understand unless you've been through the whole cycle.
Yeah. You know, I learned a lot in this process, even after the sale, where the company who bought us, after all the pleasantries were over, and once that we got into real conversations, they were like, okay, you know, we paid a premium for you guys, and JT, your next initiative is drive $1.5 million of true cost out of the business.
Oh, that's what happened?
So, because, you know, this is private equity, they want to make their return, and then they want to flip, right, in 5 to 7 years. So it's you know, unfortunately, I built a good and bad. I learned a lot. I built a high touch business model where I took care of our clients, and they weren't that way. And I'm not trying to bag on the new owners, but they had a different mentality. They didn't want high touch, and maybe they wanted those high touch people to go away too. But I know for a fact, as of last week, I know that they have had the first negative income year. Right? They did not grow; they subtracted. So. That's unfortunate. I'm not there anymore, but I know some people.
Did you quit? What was the past?
Honestly, there was no role for me there anymore. Yeah. It was more of a mutual decision. And they said, "All right, well, you know." I'll give you the reason. Make it clear. So I'm an accountability chart, sales, marketing, IT, the chief compliance officer, operations director. All rolled into me, and I was the integrator.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those guys care less about EOS model, right? So they said, okay, here's the new structure. Sales reports to the VP of sales, which makes sense. IT to the IT director. So what happened is I was down to just managing operations. Well, I built the business where that person is truly capable of running operations without me telling her, shadowing her. So at the end of the day, I just didn't have things to do. And so we had the talk, and I ended up, you know, saying, all right, well, I think it's time for the transition. And they said, yeah, you know, let's work it out. And I was on severance and all that for the last
months. What was the difference of the different 9 offers? Was it like some strategic buyers? Was it different private equity firms? And do you have any, like, what did that situation have gone differently based on the different buyers and offers?
Well, the best offer was a SaaS software business model, right? The second offer was a competitor of of the largest screening business in the country. They would have essentially wiped out our operational team, and everybody lost their jobs, really. So that was not so hot. Looking at that one, It was a nice offer too. Then we had individual people like son of a billionaire. And wants a job. And then a lot of private equity groups. Yep. Right. And then it came down to even the smaller private equity groups that wanted to do the SBA loan and said, hey, let's work out this. But ours,
that must have been a way different offer, the SBA loans, compared to the other ones. Cause I mean, that's a big spread on the different size offers, but
It was interesting. It was an interesting process, and I'm glad it all worked its way out. Now I look at it like I got the tattoo of building and now selling a company. That's good for me, I guess. I'm happy about that. And two, I think there's integrators out there. Then there's these 2.0 integrators. I look at myself more as a 2.0, where I have a little bit of visionary in me. But I'm also tactically I have operational discipline that makes me maybe different from some integrators out there. So I like to believe that there's a lot of skills that I've acquired through this, and here we are. So
what is next for JT?
Next for JT is I've had some private equity groups look at me as an operator. One. I've looked at some CRO positions. I've looked at buying some businesses. That seems very interesting. But you know what, Ryan? At the end of the day, what sounds the most interesting is finding another visionary to partner with and start doing a repeat. That actually is what I'm very interested in. But don't know when that would happen. That's hard. Well,
hopefully you're going to get a couple of calls from this interview, because I mean, I know that there's, you know, with all the presentations and the workshops and stuff that we're doing, like, you finding that role is so hard. And like you said, going back to your three, what did you say it was, you know, someone you can relate to, go to battle to, and match your core values. And like, it's so important. And if you can do that, like, then look at what you can do. I mean, it's pretty amazing.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Yeah. Looking back, I got Steve Gustafson, who I built up, and he got, you know, got a monster check, and he's retired. You know, that's a relationship I'll have for the rest of my life. I look back on the Navy SEAL, who I built his company up and became an Inc. company. You know, we're trading emails this morning because I'm flying to San Diego from the 12th to the 20th. We're trying to work out us hanging out. We chat all the time. And now he's got three kids. We're going to go hang out, spend some time together.
Cool.
And then my other shareholder, now he's CEO of Bitly. That's a huge company nationwide.
Oh, no kidding. Yeah.
Yeah. Mark Josephson. So Mark Josephson and I, you know, we're always bantering. And so I keep my visionary direct reports close, as you can see. And I look back and sitting here with a glass of wine going, God, I would love to go find another shared vision, visionary to go to battle with and mm-hmm. build something again and scale it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where I'm at while I'm looking at all opportunities, and I'm looking at business plans and looking at businesses for sale and looking at where can I add value to that too. So that's where awesome. I'm at.
So if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what's the best way?
Jonathan Thielen, like Adam Thielen from the Vikings, but we're not related. But my cell phone number is 612-720-2594. Live in Chaska, Victoria. I have a beautiful wife, three kids, 12 and twin fives.
Twins. Yes. This has been so fun, JT. Thanks so much for coming on the show.
No, I had a fantastic time with you. I look forward to getting together with you very soon. So let's promise that one.
I hope you enjoyed that episode as much as I enjoyed doing that interview with John. If you're an owner, this is a way for you to get a peer into the conversations that you either have had or need to have with the second in command that is currently on staff. If you do not currently have someone on staff, you can tell from what Steve did with JT that there's huge amounts of return on that investment of paying someone well, getting on the same page, compensating them correctly, because it is worth so much money if you're focusing on value creation as it relates to the value of your company instead of focusing on annual income. The conversations that John and I were having are real conversations that you need to have. If you do not do that and you wait till the very end and you try and sneak around your executives to sell the company without them, they are what someone's buying, and they have the chance to blow the whole deal up if they aren't amazing, genuine, integrity-filled people like John is. So between John's integrity and how he handled that and how he got on the same page and he went to battle and what happened, you can see that there's an amazing outcome that's possible for you if you, one, talk to the integrator or the second in command, whoever you have. Two, if you can go hire them and get them on board to tie them to your ultimate goal. I swear on my life that you can get what you want if you think about it and articulate it correctly. What I found interesting about having some conversations with John afterwards is that they didn't necessarily explore ESOPs or some other things. So if you want to know, and you're sitting there as the owner, how do I explore all my options? Check out one of our boot camps. We walk through for 2 days all the different ways you can figure out what you want from your business and why, using the five principles, which is your drivers. What are the financial targets? What are the different exit options, and how to compare ESOPs, private equity, third parties, the fourth principle of increasing the value of your company, and the multiple, tying all the things together that John was talking about, and then the team of advisors. We walked through all that stuff in 2 days using case studies of two companies that are $10 million in revenue and $1 million in EBITDA. So you can see between two companies all the pros and cons of all the different situations as it relates to the five principles. And you don't have to do anything besides ask questions and learn and chat with other owners that are in the group. So with that being said, I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Tune into next week where I talk to Gino Wickman about his new book, Entrepreneurial Leap, and how to identify whether you're truly an entrepreneur that is ready to take the leap. And if you're a current business owner, things that you should be asking yourself to identify if you're doing what you love and how what you are made of and the reasons that you started your business impact what you ultimately want from your company in a growth and exit. Thanks very much for tuning in, and I will see you next week.